Speaker Cliff R. from Augusta, Georgia.
Hey everybody, my name is Cliff Richards. I'm an alcoholic. I'd just like to thank the specific group and Bob for having me here tonight. Just an honor to be here to speak. I was a member here at the specific group back in 2003 when I came here from Augusta to work on a contract. I'm a contractor with the Air Force, so I travel around, and I came here to work on a contract, and it just so happened my sponsor had just died about a month before, and it was a guy that I had as a sponsor for 17 years. My sobriety date's July 7th, 1977. And I just celebrated 30 years. Actually, I celebrated in August because I was traveling. Couldn't get back to my home group. And so I celebrated in August. And I asked my sponsor to come speak, but he had other important things to do. He had to do something more important than that. So I kind of got a resentment about that. But after I got over it, it was really good. I was just grateful to be able to celebrate it. Can everybody hear me in the back? Huh? Speak up. Okay. I'd just like to take a few minutes to welcome the newcomer. The newcomers is a big group tonight. I don't know if this is your first time in or if you've been in two or three times, or doesn't really make any difference, but the key is that you're here. Just don't leave. Just stay with us. I remember when I was living in here in Vegas, I had an apartment up in Summerlin, and I turned the TV on one morning to just look at the news, and the anchorwoman was reporting an accident that happened the night before down on I-15. Excuse me. And I've never forgotten this incident because it just summed up my life as an alcoholic. And it was a report of a guy, a pedestrian, who got struck by a vehicle crossing I-15 down by the strip. And she was reporting the conversation between the 911 dispatcher and this individual. And what had happened was, and just see if you can identify with this as an alcoholic. Here was a guy who was under the influence of drugs and alcohol who wanted to cross over I-15, is it? That's right? Yeah, I-15. And instead of walking, I don't know, quarter of a mile down the street to go over an overpass, he decided to take a shortcut. I can see a lot of you relate. My whole life is about taking shortcuts. The easier, softer way. And what had happened was this guy, he jumped the fence and he crossed one lane of traffic and he got to the median and he panicked. And he had a cell phone, he called 911. And I know that feeling of fear. I know it all too well. And he called the called 911, and he told the dispatcher that he was drunk and he was in the middle of I-15, he needed help. And she said, stay right there, help's on the way. Don't leave. And like I did so many times in my life, full of fear, I run. When I'm overwhelmed with fear, waiting is not an option. It's not in my vocabulary. And he didn't wait. And when I'm in motion in a state of fear, devastating consequences occur. Always. This guy apparently thought he could make it. He darted out. And he didn't get hit once, he got hit by three different vehicles, and it was so violent it it cut him in pieces. And the anchor woman made an interesting comment. She knew nothing about a guy that's drunk, or she knew nothing about us. I don't know if the guy was an alcoholic or not, but I know that any sober person's not going to end up in the median at I-15 at midnight. So it's safe to say the guy was under the influence. But she made this comment. She said, if he only had have had presence of mind to wait, help was on the way. When I'm under the influence, I don't have presence of mind. When I'm 2 or 3 days or 30 days from a drink, I don't have presence of mind. That's why Helen talked about sponsorship. It is so vitally important to my life. And I never forgot that, that little incident, because it just summed up me in the way I operate. And I know with a crowd this size, with as many newcomers as we have, there's somebody standing in the median tonight. I'm just saying, wait. Just don't leave. Just stay with us. You're here, why not stay? So I just wanted to say that because I just saw this many people here and the newcomers, and it just reminded me of that report that I've never forgotten. But I'm grateful to be here tonight. I introduced myself as an alcoholic, and that's what I am. But long before I ever took my first drink, I was selfish and self-centered. And the big book's real clear about that. It says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. When I was going through school and with my job and business and life, I was always taught, when there's a problem, don't just address the symptom, go back to the problem, to the root of it. But so just by the nature of that, being selfish and self-centered, when I stop drinking, that's just not enough for me. The big book, in the reading we read tonight, the A, B's, and C's. A, I'm alcoholic, can't manage my own life, sober. B, that probably no human power could ever relieve our alcoholism. And see that God could and would if he were sought. And you know, that's what my whole recovery is about, getting me to the place and to the point that I know without a shadow of a doubt that God could and would if he were sought. So you newcomers, if you hear this word God thrown around a little bit, just try not to form any judgments about it. Just don't build up any resistance. Just allow it to be. And I tell the newcomers that come into my home group in Augusta, if you want to find this God we talk about, find a sponsor. I know from my experience, I find a sponsor, I'm going to get hooked up with this power that I hear talked about in the rooms. But I was raised in Augusta, Georgia. I come from a large Catholic family. There were 10 kids in my family. And I'm the oldest boy. You know, you don't really have to tell anybody you're a Catholic when you tell them there were 10 kids. It's pretty obvious. And it was pretty interesting growing up. On both sides of my family, there was two couples, and they each had one child each. There were Southern Baptist families on both sides of us. And I know that many, many times they would hear what was going on in that house with those 10 kids thinking, those are a bunch of heathens. You know, I mean, there was always something going on there. But my father was a wonderful guy. He was the best man I've ever known. I wish I could be half the man my father was. He was a small business owner. He owned a little automobile body shop in Augusta. He wasn't a smart man. He wasn't a smart businessman, but he was an honest man. And his honesty got him a lot further than any intellect I think he could have had. People loved him. People respected him. His nickname was Smiley. He was always smiling. He was just a happy guy. He was a heavy drinker. I don't think he was an alcoholic. He didn't suffer from the problems that I have, the resentments, the things that I deal with. He was just, I think, a heavy drinker. Did all of his drinking at home with my mother. But at an early age, I guess maybe 13 or 14 years old, whenever I heard that my mother was expecting another child, man, I just got resentful. Because I knew it was going to be that much less for me. They were going to be taking something of mine. And to this day, I mean, there's 10 kids and 28 grandchildren and six or seven great-grandkids. When we get together today, it's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. But back then, man, I resented it. I hated who I was and where I came from. I remember learning early on that if I was going to get anything, I was going to have to work for it because my family couldn't really give me the things that I needed, you know? And I used to go to work with my dad as a kid in that automobile shop. And, you know, in Augusta in August, it's hot, man. It's hot here, but it's humid back home. It's brutal. And every day, my dad would stop at this local bar to have a few beers. And he would leave me in that truck an hour, 2 hours, until he came back out. And he would park down this little side street where that bar was. And I would watch that door from the time he went in till the time he came out. I was overwhelmed with fear. I don't know what I was scared of. I was just scared. And I would see him coming out of that bar, and I would see him get to the truck, and he would get in, and I would get this sense of relief that I was going to be okay. But there was something else going on that I didn't even realize until I got into recovery. You know, he would get in that truck, and I would smell the beer and alcohol on him. And I think I associated the smell of beer and alcohol with the fact that I'm going to be okay. Because I remember as a young guy walking into a bar after work, knowing I was probably going to get fired the next day, or my girlfriend had just broke up with me, or something going on that I was just consumed with fear. And I remember walking into a bar and smelling that bar. And I get a whiff of that scent of alcohol, and I knew help was on the way. That's a trigger. My senses are triggers. And for you newcomers, triggers will kill us. You can be sober 30, 60 days, and a trigger, one little small thing like the smell of alcohol or the sound of ice hitting a glass. Man, I love that sound today. That's a trigger. That's why you need to be connected with someone that you can talk about these things with, someone that can help you. You know, the reading says without help is too much for us. And that's true. We can't do it alone. But I started drinking, I guess, 14 or 15 years old and just experimenting with beer. And I went through Catholic grammar school and high school and we all knew each other from day one. And the alcoholic life was the only normal life I ever knew. I remember when I was a freshman in high school, walking out of the gym one night after football practice, and I needed a ride home. And there was a car out in the parking lot. It was dark. The lights were on. It was running. It was a buddy of mine, a guy by the name of Carl. Now, Carl was 18 years old, and he was a sophomore in high school. He had been in reform school in Boys Town, USA, and been in trouble. He was an alcoholic. I didn't recognize it at the time because I was just selfish and self-centered. Carl had a blue 61 Ford with blue tinted windows. You know, we tinted windows back in the 60s, but we used a spray can. It was actually a... It was. You could get a spray can and tint your windows, whatever color you wanted. Yeah, and it looked good from the outside, but you get in, and man, all these rooms in there, you know. Well, I saw Carl's car out there, and the lights on, the car running, and I couldn't see in, but I opened the door, and Carl was passed out behind the wheel, just sitting out in the middle of the parking lot. And I woke him up and I said, "Carl, I need a ride home. Slide over." I don't know what I thought I was going to do with Carl when I got him to my house. I guess let him sit out in front of my house with the motor running all night. I don't know. But I started driving home, and he said, "Go by this girl's house." He wanted to talk to this girl. So I pull up into this Country Club Hills area, which is an exclusive area in Augusta. And I pull into this girl's driveway, and the lights are shining in the house, and the family's in there eating dinner. And I go to the door and ask for this girl. I say, "Carl wanted to speak to you out here." And I turn around, and Carl's had climbed out of the car and was having a seizure in the front yard. Her father was a physician. He came out and started tending to Carl, and the neighbors started coming around. The paramedics came, and I just got my little gym bag, and I just disappeared through the crowd, and I walked home. Never thought any more about Carl. I'm selfish and self-centered. All I was looking for was a ride home. Went to school about a week later, and they said, "They found Carl this morning. He was dead." And he had parked his car down a subdivision that was newly developed and got stuck. We think he got stuck. We think he staged it. Because when they found him the next morning, the car was running, and Carl was up underneath the back with a stick like he was trying to get it unstuck. But his jacket was pulled over the exhaust pipe. I don't think Carl could handle the pain of this disease any longer. And at 18 years old, he said he was done. And from that point on, people all around me were dying of alcohol-related deaths. You know, back in the 60s, it was an era of high-performance cars, and octane and alcohol never mix. And they were dying left and right, and I never thought anything about alcoholism. When I was about 22 years old, I lived in a house with five other guys. It was on a lake in Augusta. And it was a big two-story house, and there was a road in front, and across on the other side of the road was a nice lake. And we had a boathouse there, and we keep our boats there, and we would go skiing, and in the summers we partied at the boathouse, and in the winters we partied in our house. And a buddy of mine and another couple decided to go to a University of Georgia football game one Saturday morning. And Athens, Georgia is about an hour and a half drive from Augusta. So we got in my car and we loaded our cooler up with beer and we went to the football game. I never saw the football game. I was in a blackout the entire day. And the only thing I remember was about 1 o'clock the next morning, we were getting thrown out of a fraternity house. And I remember getting in my car and people saying, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." That's what they said, I said. And I drove from Athens, Georgia, to Augusta city limits, an hour and a half in a blackout. And there's about a 30-mile stretch going into the city of Augusta that you have to get on I-20. And when I got to the city line at a high rate of speed, I went up underneath an 18-wheeler in a blackout. And from an eyewitness, the only thing that kept me from being decapitated and everyone else was that they were down in the seats asleep. And before I went under that truck, I just fell over in the seat. They saw me just fall over. And I remember waking up after surgery in the hospital thinking, oh my God, I've destroyed my car. My buddy, I almost killed him. I never thought about him. I never thought about the couple in the back. My first thought was me. We had a 50-year reunion, excuse me, anniversary of my high school. Not my 50-year reunion now. We had it this month, actually. And I saw that girl that was in the back seat for the first time. And I went up to her, and I made an amends. And I told her that I apologize for that incident, that I'm an alcoholic, and that that was not the last time that I drove in a blackout. I drove many other times since then. And then I asked her to forgive me for that. And you know, she told me, she said, it's okay, don't worry about it. But she said, you know, ever since that night, I've never been able to sleep in a car or sleep in a plane. If I fall asleep, I just wake up, just terrorized. And you see, the consequence of our actions not only affect us, but it affects other people. It permanently affects other people. That's why my amends are so important. And I remember waking up out of that, in that hospital, after that accident, and I said, I've got to stop drinking. I can't keep doing this. And about Thursday, the guys that I live with said, we're having a party Friday night at the house. I said, no, man, I've quit. I'm done. I got to stop. So I decided, my best thinking here, I said, I'm going to get a date. I'll go out to dinner, go to the movie. And by that time, 11 o'clock or so, I'll go by the house and the party will be winding down, right? Here I was bandaged up from having plastic surgery. My eyes are black and blue. On the way back to my house after the movie, the thought hit me. I'd been about 6 days without a drink, and I was coming unraveled. And the thought hit me, just pull in the liquor store, get a half a pint, just take a couple of drinks tonight, a couple of drinks tomorrow, enough to get you by. I thought, that sounds like a good idea. So I get in the liquor store, and the thought hit me again. Ah, man, get a fifth. That way, you save money, and you can make it last a lot longer. You think like I do, I can tell. Well, I got a fifth. At about 11 o'clock, I went to the party. Everybody was there, having a good time. And I woke up the next morning, covered with blood. And I walked into my roommate's room, and he had this big black eye. I thought, what happened last night? He said, man, I don't know, you went crazy. He says, you got in a fight. I said, with you? He said, no, with Pat, another guy. He said, I was trying to break it up and you hit me. And I was I went downstairs after that, and the house was a wreck, and that fifth bottle was sitting there on the counter and it was empty. And I was just like the guy in the big book. sitting at the bar thinking, how did this happen? How did it happen? Bob is my sponsor. Bob talks about Carl Jung in the big book. Carl Jung's philosophy was synchronicity. I went to the bookstore and got that book. Man, I could not read it. It was way up here, you know. But here's synchronicity in a nutshell. And I love this explanation. At a point in a person's life when they commit to change, the universe begins to line up everything they're going to need to make the transition. And I know that's true in my life. Shortly after that incident, I knew that I was going to die. I had this overall sense that something bad was getting ready to happen. And out of desperation, I committed to change, just like all of us have done in here. And people began to show up that I don't know where they came from, but they began teaching me about steps one, steps two, step three. And before you know it, the desire to drink was removed real quickly for me, and I don't quite understand it, but it did. But along with that is a blessing. You know, I didn't struggle with picking up a lot of white chips. But with that comes a curse. And the curse is this, that I thought I was okay. I thought I was okay. And you see, because my problem is I'm selfish and self-centered. And in recovery, my life was driven by selfishness and self-centeredness. Most of my amends were in recovery. People I hurt, people I harmed and stepped on and walked over because of what I thought I needed. And I got hooked up with a guy that was my sponsor for 17 years. His name was Jack O'Connell. Jack was my sixth grade football coach. I've known him. I knew him all my life. Jack was a guy that, after college, got into drugs and alcohol, went to prison, just led a pretty rough life, got in recovery, turned his life around, built a successful wholesale distribution business in town, and retired at 56 years old. And Jack had Hep C from drug use years earlier. And I learned a lot about this power that we talk about in here through his life. He had heart problems, and he couldn't get on a donor list until his heart situation squared away, and he did. And he ended up getting a transplant at Charleston Medical Center in Charleston, South Carolina. And after the transplant, it went successful. The doctor came in the room and he was pale. He was distraught. Something was wrong, and we could tell. He said, the surgery went perfect. He said, there's one problem. He said, when we took your liver out, there was a tumor on it the size of a golf ball. And he says, we cannot figure out how we missed it. All the tests we ran, everything we did, we should have seen it, but we couldn't see it. Had we had seen it before, you would have never got this healthy liver because your body is riddled with cancer. But he says, you've got it now, and let's just make the best of it. And Jack was a guy that really pushed working with others, really pushed that. He told me one day, he said, and I was doing nothing in recovery, just selfishness and self-centeredness. He said, God's going to bring someone across your path one day, and you're going to have nothing to give them. Nothing. And I did nothing about it. And I had a brother-in-law that married, he had married my younger sister. At the time they married, he was a heavy drinker, and it escalated to the point they got a divorce, and he was an alcoholic, full-blown alcoholic. And all through the years, I would see him and, hey, man, you need to come to AA with me. And looking back, I know what he was thinking. If AA has done that to you, I don't want anything you got, because my life was run on selfishness and self-centeredness. And he died at 42 years old of alcoholism. And I remember sitting in that funeral, looking at my sister, was devastated. Three beautiful children, devastated. And I heard a voice. It said, that was the guy I brought across your path. All those years back, I had nothing to give him. And when that settled in, it was awful painful. And I made a commitment that night on my knees that when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I promised my hand would be there. And to my best ability, I've been able to do that. I've made some mistakes, but I've been able to do that. And my youngest daughter and my sister's youngest daughter, whose father had died of this disease, are inseparable. And everywhere I take my daughter, she goes with us. It is kind of my way of maybe righting a wrong, you know? We go to the beach together. We go skiing together. We go everywhere together. And at first, I would catch myself. I'd have my arm around my daughter and hug her and kiss her. And I could see Ashley looking at me. And I know what she was thinking. She was thinking I'd give anything if my daddy was still here. I know that. And sometimes we'll be just driving in the car and she'll be real quiet. And I know what she's thinking. You know, the promises say we will not regret the past. But it doesn't say we won't have painful reminders. And that's a painful reminder for me. And so I try to do the best I can in that area today. But Jack, my sponsor, started doing excellent after the liver transplant. And every 2 weeks, he would have to drive back to Charleston Medical Center to get a checkup to make sure his body wasn't rejecting the liver. And about 6 or 8 months after the transplant, he and his wife were coming back one day on I-26, and someone ran him off the road. And their car flipped about 8 times. And Jack was in the passenger seat, and the windshield post came down and hit him in the head, and it broke his neck. And he was paralyzed from the neck down. I was in Montgomery, Alabama at Maxwell Air Force Base working on a contract, and I got the call from his wife. She says, you need to get up here. We've had a terrible accident. So I dropped what I was doing to go to Charleston, and I walk in ICU, and I knew this guy for 17 years. He knew everything about me, and I knew everything about him. And when I walked in that room that day, he couldn't talk because of all the tubes in him, but he communicated with me through his eyes. And here's what I heard. This is the hand God dealt me. I've just got to play it out. That's what I heard him say to me. He stayed there about a month in Charleston, and they transported me back to Augusta to Walton Rehab, which was a, it was a rehab facility for spinal injuries. And Jack's injury was what they call complete. In other words, he will never have any use of anything from the neck down. And it just so happened that I was finishing up my contract in Alabama, and I have long stretches of periods that I'll be between work and I'll be at home. And I thought, this is a perfect time for me to give back to him for all he'd done for me. So my routine for the next 4 months was to drop my daughter off at school, and I went straight to Walton Rehab. And I would get there about the time the nurses were getting him out of bed to take him to the gym for physical therapy. And I actually got good at putting the sling under him and hoisting him up. You know, it's like an engine hoist, you know? And put him in his wheelchair, and every day I took him out of the room down to the gym. And after a couple of weeks, the nurses said, "Are y'all brothers?" "No, just friends." "Cousins?" "No, just friends." And they would just shake their head. And you see, that's what recovery has taught me, to be able to give back, to not be so selfish and self-centered. But about the first week Jack was in rehab, I went in one morning and he said, "God spoke to me last night." I said, "What did he say?" He said, "I heard a voice. It said, you can make a difference." He said, "I woke up and I thought someone was in the room." And now his range of motion was just as far as he could see with his eyes now. He couldn't move nothing. And he said, "I went back to sleep and I heard the voice again. It said, you can make a difference." And I said, "How in the hell can I make a difference? Look at me." I went in the next morning and Jack told me that. He says, "How can I make a difference?" I said, "I don't know, man. I don't have a clue." But you see, Jack knew C. Jack knew C of the A, B's, and C's, that God could and would if he were sought. And I think Jack started praying that. "Show me how I can make a difference." And an amazing thing happened. The next week, a guy came in across the hall who was paralyzed from the waist down. He was a college student, a young black guy who was in culinary school, who was in a car accident. And we heard him. He was full of anger, in a rage when they brought him in. He had given up on life. And the next day I walk in there and I put Jack in the wheelchair and I take him out to the gym and he says, "Pull in that room right there." I says, "You talking about that room?" I said, "Jack, that guy is not in any shape to be talking to you." He said, "I said, pull in the room." We opened the door. The guy never made eye contact with us. Jack just said, "Hey, man, I know how you feel. It's going to be okay." That's all he said. He left and we went to the gym. The next day, I get Jack in the wheelchair, take him to the gym, pull in that room. I said, "Man, we got to go to that room again. That guy is not wanting to talk to you." I said, "Pull in the room." He stuck his head in the door and said, "Hey, man, I know how you feel. You're going to make it." And he did that. We did that every day for a month. And I'm in the gym one morning after we had stopped by his room. And I look up, and here comes Tony, the guy. The next day, we go in, Hey, man, you're going to make it. Tony comes into the gym. And a couple of weeks later, I look up and Tony's over there smiling and laughing. Jack stayed in Walton Rehab 4 months. They normally keep you there a month. But he began to show signs of movement in his fingers, and they thought, this is weird. This is not supposed to happen. That's the only reason they kept him there. I think they kept him there for Tony. I think it was God's way of keeping him there for Tony. 4 months later, Jack was leaving the Walton Rehab, and I did the same routine. I hoisted him up, put him in the wheelchair, dressed him. He was going home for the first time in 5 months. And we were sitting there waiting on the doctor to come and discharge him. And the door opened. And it was Tony. It was Tony. Tony had got the nurse to put him in his wheelchair. And Tony wheeled himself over to Jack's room. And he pulled up beside Jack and put his hand on Jack's arm. And he said, thank you for making a difference. Jack lost it. I lost it. Tony lost it. Jack's wife lost it. You see, Jack knew that God could and would if he was sought. I sat there looking at Tony and Jack, two guys paralyzed, broken, paralyzed, full of fear, not knowing anything about the future, and they were going to be okay. And I looked at Tony and I said, that's exactly what he did for me. Every day, when I would talk to him, he would say, man, you're going to make it. Everything's going to be okay. It was an amazing thing to experience that. That 4 months, he taught me more than he did in 17 years. And I'm grateful for it. He died, Jack died in July of 2003. And I came to Vegas in September of 2003. And I was a mess. I didn't come to Vegas looking for a sponsor. I came to Vegas to do a job. And God brought Bob into my life. So I just want to say to the newcomer, just don't leave. Just stay with us. Help's on the way. If you get plugged into this specific group, I promise you, your life will change. You'll make it. And Bob, thank you for making a difference. I want to thank the specific group for having me tonight. It's just been an honor. God bless you. Keep coming back. Works if you work it.